Since this is my last go at you, I must thank you for the hospitality that I have enjoyed as the West lecturer this year. You have been uncommonly kind. You have let me listen to your choir, angelic as they are. I thank you for all that hospitality. People have expressed appreciation to me in a variety of ways, and I should like now to express my gratitude to these musicians, and I wonder whether you are inclined to join me. You are in the position of a senior college class that had endured people like me for 4 years. They decided, the senior class did, to have one last caper at the country club before graduation. Hardly had they begun than the most beautiful young woman in the class leaned too far over a deep pool of water and dropped a precious diamond earring. All the gallant young men rushed forward to help a maiden in distress, and she held them off with a marvelous gesture and called on her tired old professor of English to retrieve the diamond earring. The old boy was flattered as he had not been flattered in 40 years of teaching. He didn't even take his shoes off, he just jumped in. When he recovered the diamond earring, he said to the young woman, "I was delighted to do it, but why did you ask me?" And she said to him, "I took a course under you the first semester I was here and every year thereafter, and I learned the first day that you can go down deeper and come up drier than anybody I know." I am sure there have been moments when you twitched in your seat, and there may still be some. But I thank you for not having thrown anything and for having generally been decent and kind. I invite your attention for a few moments to what I call a touch of blue, or making the common uncommon. There's an ancient story in the Christian tradition that when the Holy Family were going down to Egypt, our Blessed Mother got tired of riding the donkey. Who wouldn't? And that just outside of Cairo, in a little village which happens to be my wife's hometown, our Blessed Mother Mary got off the donkey, took off her blue shawl and laid it over a scraggly old green fir tree and rested for a little while. And when they got up to go, Mary picked up her shawl and somebody noticed that the scraggly old green fir tree had turned into a beautiful blue spruce. A touch of blue. I think blue is a maligned color, if you don't mind my saying so. We use it a lot more than we realize. I'm an adopted son of Boston. I've seen blue blood, and there is something there, even though I don't belong to it. Who gets anywhere in college unless you're willing to risk a blue book or two? Some of you lay people have blue chips. I hope. Because the clergy certainly don't. Once in a blue moon. And what's it like if the moon is full twice in the same month? Wow, you could hardly take that. A generation ago, when men didn't know what to do with educated women, they called them blue stockings. It was supposed to be a put down, but it didn't work. Singing the blues, which is anything but blue, huh? It dreams of what once was and what can be again. Blue sky. I'm a country kid. I went to county fair for 20 years. I never did get a blue ribbon. But someday. That's important to me. And the most important thing in the world is if somebody should say to you, "She's true blue." No wonder the Vatican is beginning to say we shouldn't wear the same color purple before Advent and Lent. And do you know next year the Roman Catholics are going to wear blue at Advent? I'm playing a winning side. I want you to know that. I want a touch of blue in our lives. And for that for me, that means not only that God takes the ordinary and makes it extraordinary, but it means that God takes our individual talents which have been given and asks us to put them together so we'll have something to give God. A touch of blue. And I thought, how can I talk about this kind of unity? Because people are so familiar with the figures. People have heard about vines and branches until they don't even listen anymore. St. Paul talked about the human body. If anybody but St. Paul had been doing that, we would have criticized it, because it leaves too much opportunity to describe some of us. But then I thought, is it all right that my Lord is a carpenter? And he's building a household of faith. And if I promise to behave from noon on, could I say to you that we are the nails that hold the household of faith together? This is so simple, if you can't understand it, you better see your doctor. The nails that hold it together. Down underneath there are spikes. I keep on my desk, 18 inches long. You know, foundations, they're like bishops and church treasurers. You never see them, but presumably they work. They hold the bases together. We need some spikes in a church. I think of the flatheads on the roof. We got some of those in the church. They hold it on, don't they? If they don't do their job, the spikes will rot out, you know. Won't get the job done. Am I boring you stiff? I was once at a building site when the hardware store came and they brought kegs and kegs of 4-penny, 6-penny, 8-penny nail. Good old common stuff without which you can't build a church. I think of finishing nails. They have no heads at all. Got a lot of those in the church. But they hold the pretty on. And life would be pretty miserable without the pretty, wouldn't it? Someday I hope to make enough money to buy one piece of furniture made with wooden nails. Did you ever notice? You have to hunt to see where they are, because they lose themselves in the thing that they hold together. Wow. When I was a kid, there was no greater joy for me out in my father's shop than to take a bent nail and make it straight and pound it in to some good purpose. Do you hear me? I think of scaffolding nails. They got double heads. We don't have very many of those in the church. Two faces, yes. Two heads, not very many. But you know, you'll whoop them into place and they still stick out so you can use them again. Every church needs 6 or 8 of those. I want to be a nail in the household of Christ. I really do. With you and build it. And I've learned that all these nails, as diverse as they are, have got 3 or 4 things in common. Do you have that kind of time before you go to lunch? Please. The first thing I've noticed is that a nail isn't much good if it doesn't have a head. It doesn't hold much. And I kind of want to infer from that members of the church aren't much good if they don't know why they're here. If we don't understand why we came. In the Minneapolis airport, there is a bar called the Golden Eagle Bar, into which I have never entered, but through which I can see well, given this Methodist ecclesiastical vision. And over the bar, there is a beautiful legend in big gold letters that says, "Be sure you're on board before you begin to fly." If there's anything we don't need, it is headless Christians, dummies, who don't know our tradition. I am so honored to have studied with some of you since last Friday night in this place. I shall go away from First Church Corpus Christi knowing that there are minds in this place, that there are people who are willing to offer their heads to God through Jesus Christ, that there are people who are willing to think. You know, nobody has been nasty to me in 4 lectures. Now, that could derive from the fact that I didn't say anything, but it might also derive from the fact that even though people don't agree with them, they're willing to listen, to share, to give back and forth. Dear God, give us a head so that we can join this community and build a household of faith. George Santayana, the great philosopher, once defined a fanatic as somebody who, having forgotten his purpose, redoubles his effort. Maybe that's why a lot of evangelism is more emotional than substantive. And maybe that's why a lot of evangelism is an affront to the intelligence of people like members of First Church in Corpus Christi. Maybe we need to know our tradition. I was in Australia and a member of the church said to me, after tea, let's go look at kangaroos. And I said to her, I saw one once. Which was not gracious at all of me. She had planned no other entertainment. So outside of Canberra, we went out at feeding time and I stood among 850 kangaroos. I almost got pouched. And then she looked at me and I discovered why she invited me as an American out to that hillside. She said, there's something I'd like to have you know about kangaroos. I said, what is it? Boy, I walked into this one. She said, they have 44 teeth and a very small brain. I keep wondering why she told me that. Should I feel hurt? Well, of course I should if she meant it. I want us to offer our heads. Please. Then when individually we take the gifts to God into a corporate effort, we will turn the ordinary into something extraordinary. Second thing I observe about a nail is it's got a point. I told you this was profound. But do we? One of the bumper stickers I like, you heard what I think of them, one of the bumper stickers I really like says, think globally and act locally. Have you said anything about South Africa? Do your kids know what you think about the fact that kids 10 and 11 years of age are in jail in South Africa for as long as 3 or 4 months without any indictment? Are you really the hands of God's justice? Is there a point to our being? I don't think these are impertinent questions. I'd like to suggest that we live in a time which terribly trivializes people. Now, trivialize is a word that a good preacher like Dan Solomon wouldn't use in the pulpit, but I do. To trivialize means to take something that's really important and bring it down, and something that isn't really important and bring it up. I got up the other morning to finish a sermon. It was Sunday. I turned on the radio, CBS, and heard these stunning words. The weekend was made for sports. That really sets a preacher up, you know. Or listen to this. Coca-Cola is the real thing. They don't even believe that at Emory University. Or how about this one? IBM will make it all come true. There's a funeral text if I ever heard one. Or Harvey's Bristol Cream, which makes anything downright upright. Oh, come on, you gotta be kidding. Is there a point to our lives that says, you stop demeaning people? L'Oréal, I know it costs more, but I deserve it. Every time I hear that, I want to put my foot through the television. The worst one of all, of course, as you know, those ugly brown spots, of which I notice an increasing number. I want you to know that some of the most beautiful people in my life have got ugly brown spots. I'm going to catch that woman someday and drop her in a whole tub of porcelain and you will never hear from her again. What is this trivializing that says if you're pretty on the outside, it doesn't make any difference whether you're dry ashes inside? I'm sorry, we're here to build the carpenter's household of faith, and the carpenter can't do much without nails. Let's use our heads. Let's have a point to our lives, please. I was down in North Carolina, sitting at breakfast with a retired college president. And he was recounting, I'm talking about Harold Hudson, and he was recounting the days in the 30s when, as president of Greensboro College in North Carolina, they had an awful time placing graduates in jobs. And one year they had a brilliant young man who was a music teacher. June, no job. July, August, September. Finally, in October, they got a call from a little high school in western North Carolina saying, send us a music teacher. He went, he was brilliant. The end of the year, the school board said, "We like what you did. Will you also teach agriculture next year?" As you know, the two are closely related. And American education has a wonderful way of rewarding good teachers. He said no, and they said yes or else, so he did. And the first day he was supposed to lecture about sheep, of which he knew nothing, he cleared his voice and he said, "The sheep of the world are divided into two groups. There are rams and there are ewes." Some of the students wiggled a little. So he got closer and said, "The sheep of the world are divided into two groups. There are rams and there are ewes." And one of the courageous students stuck his hand up and said, "That's not the way we talk around here. Is that right? We say ewes." And the teacher, who had had a lot of courses in education, said, "Well, there are two schools of thought about that." I've got news for you. No two schools of thought about whether or not Christians ought to be saying in the 21st century, "They will know we are Christians by our justice." Because anybody can love. But if it never leads to anything, if love is never activated, how do they know we're Christians? Can you hear me? Are you sorry you did? I'd love to have a head which has been used. I'd love to have a point to my life. I have a hobby which I have not really professed much yet, and that's visiting cemeteries. I get a big kick out of tombstones. It's going to be a long time. You might as well enjoy them while you can. One day I was in London and I went to Bunhill, which is where the nonconformists of England were buried for 200 years. What a day I had. William Blake, Daniel Defoe, George Fox, Susanna Wesley, even. I was ready to go when an Englishman came up from behind a tombstone and he said, "Have you seen Isaac Watts?" And I said, "I did not know he was here." He took me to the biggest slab of concrete I've ever seen over a grave, which is something given our postmortem competition, on the side of which were two words. Brilliantly, it must have been the work of a committee. I wonder how many Thursdays they met. Isaac Watts. I said to him, "How ironic. This man wrote more than 100 beautiful hymns. As long as you poured all that concrete, why didn't you put a line of poetry there?" And he said, "What would you put there?" Now, when a layman asks an honest question, be careful. They already know the answer. They've just given you a run for your money. And I, who have never kept quiet at the right time, said, "Oh God, our help in ages past." I didn't think that was, he said, "You're wrong." So I said humbly, "What should I have said?" And he said, "You should have said, 'When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died.'" He was right. One guy in history whose life was bigger than his mouth. And who, when the push came to shove, proved that he had a point to his life for others. Can you hear me? The third thing I want to say is that a nail is usually put into place by a power bigger than itself. Now, some of you are going to get nervous, especially if you're liberals, and I'm only from Boston. Let me say it again, just in case you didn't want to hear it. A nail's got to be put into place by a power bigger than itself. I'm not going to tell you how. There are so many crazy ways of getting converted that I'm looking for good ways. But it's not my business to tell. This I know, that the people who count in the church know of a time when they said yes in a decisive way to God and to the human race. I believe in conversion. It doesn't happen to happen some Saturday night in a football stadium. Just as I believe when at a wedding service a young man says, "I do," he doesn't mean except when I'm out of town or in a motel with somebody else. I'm meddling now, I beg your pardon. put into place by a power bigger than itself is important to me. Boris Pasternak says the world has changed in two ways. One is with the whip, and that doesn't work in the 20th century. And the other is with the inner music. Aren't most of you here because you heard the inner music in somebody else? You wanted to be like that? I think so. I promised this morning at the 8:45 service that I had to repeat a paragraph, and here it is. 3 years ago, my colleagues took up a collection to send me away. By now, you can be sympathetic. When I went to China, on Christmas Eve 1983, Lila and I went to Beijing. At 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, I went down to the lobby of the hotel and asked for a taxi. And the taxi man said, "Where do you want to go?" And I didn't know how to say church in Mandarin Chinese, so I went like this, and we ended up in a Roman Catholic church. Christmas Eve, midnight, 10 degrees below zero, no private cars, no public transportation. There were 5,000 people on their knees in front of a creche of baby Jesus. This is a country where praying together, owning a copy of scripture, or pledging allegiance to the church was a capital crime for 40 years before 1979. Next day I went to Shanghai and said to an old priest there, "How many people did you have for Christmas celebration in a church half the size or less of this one?" He said, "There were 3,000 people in here yesterday morning at a service." I said, "Any problem?" He said, "Yes, there are so many people waiting for instruction that we shall not get around to them before some of them die." I thought, what a problem. I talked to the dean of the only four-year theological seminary in all of China and said, "Did you have any problem with registration last year?" And he said, "We had 900 applications for 45 places. I met an old Chinese man who had taught mathematics in Shanghai High School for 50 years until it was found out by the Gang of Four that he was a Christian. They deposed him and sent him 50 miles from home with his wife to sort and collect garbage. I said, "Tough." He said, "Not so bad." He had 5 sons who were also educated and Christian. They were sent to 5 other towns to be garbage collectors. I said, "Tough." He said, "Not so bad." Then he got a tear in his eye. And he said, "There is something I'd like to mention to you." He knew me as a biblical teacher. He said, "When we knew that we were to be separated, I faced a problem. For 40 years, I had illegally kept a Bible in the lower drawer of the China cabinet. And every night, we would get it out and read it. And my sons never knew what was to have a day without some such study. And now we were to live in 6 different places. What to do?" And with a sob, he said to me, "I took a razor to the Bible and cut it into 6 parts. And each of us took a part. And every 6 months we'd get together and exchange the parts. And we knew the Bible." And then he said to me, as though I were some kind of oracle, "Do you think God is angry because we cut up the Bible?" I said, "I think there was a hallelujah chorus in heaven because you cut up the Bible. Was I wrong?" And it was people like him who have now led the communist government of China to say, "We will publish as many scriptures in any dialect of Chinese as the church's request." My point is not to say China is becoming a Christian country in 15 minutes. My point is to say some of those people were put into place by a power bigger than themselves. Am I worthy? You see, the question is changing, dear colleagues. The question is not in our time, can those funny Africans and Asians keep up with American Christianity? The question has flipped. Can we Americans, who have been very much favored, match the faith of our sisters and brothers in Asia and Africa? I want to be a nail in the household of God. I'd like to have a head that gets problematical as I preach. I'd like to have a point, ask my kids. I'd like very much to be put into place every day. But I've got a last point. And that is, very simply, it is the business of a nail to hold things together. I told you it was profound. Well, it is. And I've discovered that I can't hold things together unless I celebrate in the household of God. And the next 2 or 3 minutes are going to be to congratulate you for paying attention to your inner spirit by coming to church. Worship, celebration. Because in the middle of praising things you'd like to be like, you begin to become like them. Holy, holy, holy. I believe that. I believe in the middle of a good service of worship, you begin to sing and dance and do whatever you have to do. And all of a sudden you begin, can you take me seriously? To dream dreams and see visions and dance dances and write poetry and think of all the things that you will do for the people of God. Please hear me. This is where it really happens. You come to church almost angry. You finally got the kids stuffed in the car and all the baggage, and you're late, and your husband's mad at you, and why in heaven's name did we even try? And then you notice how you kind of sweeten out during the hour. So actually, when you meet the pastor in the narthex, you don't hit him, you speak to him. It's a considerable improvement. Oh, please, for whom are you dreaming dreams? For whom are you dancing dances? For whom are you writing poetry? And if you say no one, I will say stay after church. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Please. I was asked some years ago to speak to 30 Methodist bishops in Fayetteville, Arkansas. If I had any sense, I'd have said no. But I don't have much sense. And there we sat in August on a hot hill in Fayetteville. And unprepared as I was, I said to 30 Methodist bishops, what do you think your mother thought when she was changing your diapers? Shouldn't have said it. I shouldn't have said it for 2 reasons. One of which is, of course, that most bishops never wore diapers. I call them the immaculate exceptions. But then I met lay people with that kind of a problem too. May I just ask, what do you think your mother thought when she was changing your diapers? This dirty kid, I thought he'd come to a better end. But don't you know most of us are here because somebody loved us enough to have their hands in our reality and our future in their dreams. Thank you, Mama. Thank you, Papa. Thank you, teacher. And yet there are a lot of people in town who don't have anybody to dream for them. Do you? Dreams hold things together. And I want services of worship to be times as beautiful as this one everywhere. I have it on the authority of that great Roman Catholic theologian, Maurice Chevalier, that it's all right to have style in service. I love him. This is scriptural. He said, a hat is not a hat until it's tilted. I've been standing in front of the mirror in my room since yesterday, a half an hour, tilting my hat. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's all right. Said he, a rose is not a rose if it's wilted. A song is not a song until you sing it. A bell is not a bell until you ring it. Love was not put into your heart to stay. Love was put into your heart to give away. Please, won't you build the household of God? If you're a spike, hold. If you're a flathead, be. If you're a finishing nail, do it in a lovely way. And if, like me, you're a 4-penny, 6-penny, 8-penny nail, remember the carpenter himself came from pretty simple beginnings and took some pretty common stuff and made it uncommon. I think so. I gotta stop. I said this morning that next time around I want to be Italian. This being a Scandinavian and evangelical is very difficult. I said then I'd like to be Giuseppe Verdi, but choir, I've changed my mind. Is it all right? I really would like to be, get this, Giacomo Puccini. With a name like Beck, Puccini is an oratorio all by itself. I want to write opera. I really do. La Boheme, Tosca, Madame Butterfly. How much skill is given to one person? In 1922, the year I was born, That comes out to 65. In 1922, this great Puccini said, I want to write one more opera. I'm going to call it Turandot. Some people think it's his best. And his students said, but maestro, you've got cancer. Don't. And he said, I want to. And they said, suppose you die before you finish the opera. He said, if I die, you'll finish it. He wrote half of Turandot. In 1924, they took him to Brussels and he died on the operating table. The students finished that great opera. The premiere for it was to be held in La Scala in Milan in 1926 under the baton of Puccini's best student, Arturo Toscanini. It was a gala time until they came in the text to the point where Puccini had to stop writing. And in that way, I love among Italian men, tears streaming down his face. Toscanini put down the baton and turned to the audience and said, thus far the master made music, but he was taken from us. And then in a moment, his face wreathed with smiles, Toscanini picked up the baton and cried out to the audience, but his disciples finished their master's music. Will we?
That's the Old Testament and Jesus, but much more specifically, the Dead Sea Scroll community, as it shows us the way in which the Old Testament and the New Testament simply cannot be separated. In 1851, a young American, a graduate of Union College in Schenectady, New York, went to Europe for a year. He was an opera singer, a troubadour, a young gay blade, as we used to call them in the days when you could use that word. And after a year in the opera houses and in the coffee houses of Europe, he decided that he would go across the Mediterranean and spend a month or so in North Africa before he went home to the United States. On board the ship between Nice, France, and Tunis, he was taken seriously ill with a fever. And when they arrived in Tunis, he was put off the ship and put into a little Anglican mission hospital where he lingered for a few days and died. The American consular service in those days had no money to send indigent travelers home, and John Howard Payne was buried in the corner of an Anglican churchyard in Tunis, a forlorn spot which I have stood at upon an occasion in my life. 25 years later, there was introduced into the United States Congress a resolution that the body of this young man should be exhumed from his grave in Tunis, brought back to the United States, and buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full civilian honors. Notwithstanding the fact that it carried no benefit for any congressperson, that recommendation passed unanimously. And 6 months later, they brought the body of John Howard Payne to Washington. The president went, the cabinet, much of the Senate, the Supreme Court, and there was a ceremony honoring this young singer-musician. Why? What had he done? His life was very simple, but he had written four lines of poetry that every one of us in here knows. I shall recite it. Mid pleasures and palaces, though you may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. Not very great poetry, but very dear poetry. I learned another set of lines in my farm life in Nebraska, which I should also like to recite, and then we'll get on to serious things. I have a little shadow, there's a strained adjective. I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of it? I've changed it, do you mind? I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me. The only thing I've really got, my spirit, by God, set free. And what I want to talk about tonight in a very simple way, which has been the theme of my being here, and I believe the purpose of the West Lectureship, and surely one of the major influences of this parish, is that I want your kids and mine, I want our friends to remember us as people who tried to understand the tradition that we're a part of. People who were baptized in the name of a tradition when we were babies and given any luck will be buried in the name of that tradition when they carry us out feet first. If a tradition figures that prominently in one's life, it's important to try to understand it. And I will simply report to my classes that at least in one corner of the United States, there is a group of people who are willing to try to learn. May I do that? Thank you. But I think it's really important in the United States, at both personal and national levels, if I may say so. 100 years ago, the Duke of Wellington said, "Education without religion will produce nothing but a breed of clever devils." And we are getting awfully close. And we have simply got to say, a society that is technically and scientifically as skillful and brilliant as ours cannot afford to remain religious and ethical infants. At the personal level, many too many of us are breaking up in mental and spiritual health. Many too many of us are running aground. And to some degree, at least, that is because we need some real resources to face situations of the sort that confront living in the 20th century. And therefore, I am keen that we teach and understand that deeper level of the heart. For we are a people who believe that the spirit of men and women is the candle of the Lord, and I take that seriously. And that's a wonderful responsibility. It is upon us that decisions depend in community life, in the national life. I think so. I have said to some of you that I've spent 10 years in Egypt. During that period, I learned a lot of things, not all of which I needed to know. One of the stories that I love is of your desert sheikh who got lost out in the desert late at night, windy, wet, cold. After hours of deprivation, he found his way back to the tent, lit a candle, and discovered all he had was a pot of dates. He reached down, got one of the dates, held it up to the candle, noticed it was wormy, flipped it out of the flap of the tent. Reached down, got another date, held it up to the candle, noticed it was wormy, flipped it out of the flap of the tent. Blew out the candle and ate the rest of the dates. Do it all the time, don't we? Education without religion will produce nothing but a breed of clever devils. And the decisions for a decent society depend on people like you and me, not to blow out the candle and go on doing what we please. And I'm just enough of a classicist to believe, and now the lecture begins, how do you know? To believe that we need to recapture our tradition wherever possible. And therefore, I'd like this evening, if you have the patience, to tell the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which may remain the most important single archaeological discovery of the 20th century and maybe for some time to come. I want to do it under four headings. I believe in giving people some sense of progression. That way, there's hope. The first thing I want to do is deal with a completely irrelevant fact, which is not at all unusual among lecturers, except we seldom admit it. I want to admit it, and that's the thing that I would like to start with. The second thing I'd like to do is to tell a story. There's the rub. That will take 20 minutes. The third thing I'd like to do is offer three reasons why I told you the story in the second place. And then the fourth thing we must do, which we've done too little of under the pressure of time, is to open the floor to questions. Are you ready? Out in the Middle West where I grew up, we had a very definite theory of how we got the Bible. It ran something like this, that about 50 AD, just outside of Jerusalem, suddenly one June afternoon, there was an ungodly clap of thunder, the heavens opened up, and the original copy of the Bible in King James English came floating down out of the sky. It was only later translated into Hebrew and Greek so that otherwise unemployable people like me would have something to do. A little desert boy who was uncommonly well-trained in Elizabethan English ran and realized what he had, slammed it shut and ran and hid it in the nearest desert cave. And where I grew up, we knew that the original copy of the Bible, which Jesus had dictated, was someplace. I'm sorry. Of course, my people believed that. Nobody told them any differently. What we should have been told is, and oh, I love this, What we should have been told is that from 1500 before the common era, before Christ, around 100 campfires in Palestine, people sat and told stories, recounted genealogies, remembered battles, painted portraits, collected adages that they'd heard their grandmother say, and that almost everything we've got in the Bible existed for years at the oral level before it was ever written down. I remind you who are Christian that Jesus of Nazareth never once put pen to paper. Everything you've got in the New Testament is by remembered hearsay. And around 100 campfires, they told these stories. And as time went by, they began to sense that there was a list of books that seemed to be really meaningful to everybody. And as time went by, they kind of said, yeah, this is it. Here is Torah. Here is prophets. Here are the Psalms. Here's the wisdom literature. Judaism never said this is permanently closed, though they did kind of draw it to a close. They immediately began to write the Mishnah. They immediately put out the Talmud. They immediately established religious courts, one of which is right across from MIT right now, to deal with what religion says to new scientific experiments. Do you hear me? And on these magnificent scrolls, always written by hand, always in parchment, the name of God was written. And when a scroll began to wear out in ancient Judaism, they didn't hide it behind the piano in a Sunday school room. We won't go into that. But they took it and rolled it and wrapped it in clean linen and put it in a little box and buried it up in the synagogue attic or out in the cemetery next to Uncle Ezra. And as the years went by, we lost every original copy of the Hebrew Bible, which was also the Bible of Jesus and the early church. And this is my long-winded way of saying that until what I want to tell you tonight happened, our oldest copy of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, dated from 1008 AD. That's the irrelevant fact. I'll repeat it because I want you to hear it. Until the story I'm going to tell you now, our oldest copy of the Bible in Hebrew, dated from 1000 of this era, closer to us than Jesus, closer to us than to most of the writers of these books. There were only two copies. One still was and still is in the Leningrad Museum in Russia. Isn't that ironic? The other was in a synagogue in Damascus, and in 1948 it showed up on the campus of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem by a route that is better not traced, probably. That's the irrelevant fact. Please, dear colleagues, I'm not saying anything to take away the authority of the Bible. I want to get rid of a lot of the hocus pocus that ignorance allows us to keep continuing about the Bible, and which a lot of kids nowadays simply will not swallow. I'm jealous for that. Well, the first point is over. It wasn't so bad, was it? The second point I would like to do is to tell a story. So you've heard it before. That's all right. There are several good sonatas and stories you've heard before. You cannot have a story until you have characters. You can't have a story until you have a place. Will you bear with me? This is why I got rid of the pulpit. How I get rid of me, I don't know, but try to see it. The characters for this wonderful story that I have the honor to tell you lived, well, had a kind of headquarters in a little town 6 miles south of Jerusalem that's called Bethlehem, which most of you have heard of. They were a Bedouin tribe. They had sense enough to keep ahead of the IRS. You will appreciate that a month from today. And they wandered across the desert. You know, don't laugh about Bedouins. There are more nomads in America than there are any country in the world. They're just motorized. Bedouins wandering. And when the wintry wind would start to come across the spiny hill country of Palestine, this Beni Amran tribe, I happen to know one of them. He's an apartment house janitor in Bethlehem these days, and he's a friend of mine. But these Bedouin knew a good thing. they headed for the Dead Sea, Miami Beach. This Semitic propensity for warm places in the winter needs to be looked into. And the setting for our story, the setting for our story is right here at the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea. And these Beni Amran would come down there along about in December or early January. They'd pitch their black goat's hair tents along the beach. Pretend you're out in the water, huh? Face northwest. Don't worry if you can't swim. Just keep your head up and your feet down and the salt will see you through. I hope you can take a shower afterwards. It is 1946, December, or January 47. I don't know. If you'll look carefully, you will see the black goat's hair tent of the Bedouins. They are set up. At the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea, there's a little shelf of rock that arises up to a height of about 200 feet. That's the stage. And up behind it, like some God-appointed amphitheater, the Judean sandstone hills rise to 700, 800 feet, a kind of circle, and we know that it's sand clear over to the Mediterranean. December 46. Are you with me? January 47. See the Bedouin? This is a well-organized chauvinistic society. If there's any work to be done of a serious sort, let the women do it. Don't take me at my word. The men have been resting all day, and when twilight comes, they mean to roll over and rest some more. But this is also a subtropical region. And these people have sheep and goats, and there are predatory animals. And between sometime 4 o'clock tea and twilight, they always have to see that the dogs are set around the flocks. And one fateful evening, Muhammad al-Dib, my friend, Muhammad the wolf, and one of his other young bucks were told, bring in the sheep and set the dogs around them. And Muhammad knew in the spirit of a good shepherd that not all the sheep were there. He came up onto this little plateau, are you with me, and looked around and couldn't find them. Necessity is often the mother of observation. He looked up in the Judean hills and noticed pocked out caves, two or three. Like you and me had sense enough not to go into an unexplored desert cave, shinnied up there, and instead of going in, threw in a rock. How long the Bedouin were in this tent, we do not know. When later competent archaeologists came here, they found the floor littered with cigarette butts. We do not think these were left either by the Romans or the early Christians. The outside world knows nothing of this. More than a year passes, and in April or early May of 1948, you see, this is just crazy what I'm going to say to you now. When your pastors were in seminary, if somebody had said, we shall someday find a manuscript in Palestine from the time of Jesus, you'd have been laughed out of Perkins School of Theology up to 1950. So bear with me. May 1948, in front of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, two Bedouin boys, one of them carrying a gunny sack. Does the word gunny sack mean anything to you? Must I say a burlap bag? Burlap and gunny aren't the same, are they? A gunny sack. And they headed for the shop of a shoe merchant whose name is Candu, which is not a famous Arabic name. Every town in the world needs somebody whose name is Candu. No matter what you want done. Oh, dear colleagues, this overwhelms me because I've looked at that miserable shoe shop counter on which the Bedouin boys put down their burlap bag. And Candu said, what can I do for you? And they said, we found something in the desert. And out of that miserable burlap bag, they pulled 11 scrolls. Typically 11 and a half inches high. Typically handwritten. Typically parchment. One of them is 125 feet long. Look at it. Two nearly complete copies of the prophetic book of Isaiah. 66 chapters. Look at it. A commentary on the book of Genesis we'd never seen before. Look at it. A commentary on the book of Habakkuk, chapters 1 and 2. Scholars had always said the third chapter was a prayer and added a lot later. Look at it, a collection of psalms. None of them from the 150 that we have before David broke his bick. A lot of them new psalms. Sung at Tanglewood by the Yale University Glee Club a few years ago. Beautiful psalms. Lovely. Look at it. A manuscript called The War Between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. Because we're going to see in a little bit a reason. Look at it. A wonderful scroll. A book of rules for a community living in the desert. Miller Burroughs, professor of Yale, was there that year. He said he'd heard of a church that was ruled in America by a book called The Discipline. And he named that manuscript The Manual of Discipline. Why, Methodists have been honored in this in ways we never deserved. Can do. Do you know what we have here? We can't read Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek, neither can I. Would you take them up to Jerusalem? We'll try. Must hurry. War is going to break out between the Arabs and the Israelis in May 15, 1948. We'd better move fast. Can do went to Jerusalem. He sold 5 of the manuscripts to a Syrian archbishop who could not read Hebrew or Greek or Aramaic. Thought it might be an interesting investment. Went next door to Professor Sikinik of the Hebrew University, the father of Yigal Yadin, a former associate prime minister who died a couple of years ago. I'll get over the details in just a minute, but I want you to hear this. War broke out between the Arabs and Israelis. Archbishop Samuel was an Arab. He had to leave Palestine. He packed the 5 scrolls in a little black bag and went to the United States. They were shown in Boston, in Chicago, and then they were deposited where all good biblical manuscripts should be, in the Chase Manhattan Bank on Wall Street. The line between the sacred and the secular is very wobbly. Archbishop Samuel was transferred from being a bishop in Jerusalem to being a priest in Hackensack, New Jersey. I was speaking of the secular, wasn't I? 4 years later, are you still with me? In 1952, there appeared in that great biblical publication known as the Wall Street Journal a little four-line ad saying, Biblical Manuscripts of Great Antiquity for Sale. Lawyers for the State of Israel went incognito to Hackensack, and they bought those 5 manuscripts. And this is my long-winded way of saying that the 11 scrolls found in Qumran Cave number 1. Will you say Qumran with me? Q-U-M-R-A-N. Qumran. Qumran Cave number 1 are all back in Jerusalem and in a beautiful museum which some of you have seen on the campus of the Hebrew University called the House of the Book. For a lot of people, this is the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and by now, given these chairs, you may wish that were true. I've got awful news for you. You're not going to get your sandwiches until 6 anyway, so suffer. But the news I have for you is this, that in 1949, as soon as a truce had been drawn up between the Israelis and the Arabs, that miserable war which still persists, the king of Jordan issued a decree that the northern half of the Dead Sea should be put under martial law. He went and got an Englishman by the name of Harding and a dear Roman Catholic priest, Père Roland Devaux, who has been rattling around Jerusalem since shortly after creation, and asked them to carry out a series of campaigns. Don't let me lose you. I want you to know this. I'm convinced when your great-grandchildren live, they will say, I had a great-grandmother who lived when atomic energy was released, when Vatican II met, when the World Council was formed, and when they found Qumran. I bet you a bagel. And DeVoe and Harding, please, will you think of this? You know, a lot of people are romantic about archaeology. It's a lot better in an air-conditioned library than it is out in the desert, which is like digging post holes in Kansas in August. But between 1949 and 1955, DeVoe and Harding rediscovered Qumran number 1. They found the cigarette butts. But look what else they found, would you please? May I have my little moment? Qumran cave number 2, number 3, number 4. The only one up here on this shelf. Will you remember that one? Let's mark it so you can't forget it, please. I don't want you to get lost in the desert. Number five, number six, number seven, number eight, 10, 11 caves, and something like a lost library of manuscripts in every one of those caves. What have we here? 3 miles south of Jericho? And we've never heard of it? The greatest library of the ancient Near East, and it has been lost for 2,000 years? How can we account for this? And then Père Roland DeVoe, that dear priest, remembered. He said, notice, all the caves are located in a semicircle, and this little 2-acre shelf is almost completely free, except for that cave. And then he went and got the Manual of Discipline, a book of rules for a community living in the desert. And then he began to say, there was somebody here, and it wasn't Kilroy. There was a community here. They had sense enough to do what you and I would have sense enough to do, and that is you begin to dig around on this site. I want to tell you now, in case you're a little suspicious after the way I misbehaved, I want to say that the conclusions I'm now going to foist off onto you are supported more than 99% by scholars of the world, Catholic, Protestant, Jew, and secular. Who were here? Why had they come? How long were they here? What did they do? What happened to them? Can you take that much? Who were here was a group of Jews who had turned their back on Jerusalem because it was impure. That's a little like talking about a Roman Catholic who won't accept the sacrament at the high altar of St. Peter's in Rome. Where in heaven's name are you going? A group of Jews. There's a rule in the Manual of Discipline that says when you show up at the door to make inquiry, they ask whether or not you're willing to turn over your property on a non-refundable basis. And that separates the men from the boys. There's also a rule at Qumran that this community, you may be able to join. It's governed by a teacher and a council of 12. But if you do join, you've got to be a novice for a year. It's all in the Manual of Discipline. At the end of the year, you take a test. If you pass, you may be a novice for another year. What a privilege. And if at the end of the year you pass, then you become a member of the community. But, says the Manual of Discipline, just because somebody is a member doesn't mean you don't watch out for each other. If somebody walks sideways, speak to him. He does not listen, two of you speak to him. He does not listen, bring him up in the presence of the community. He does not listen, cast him out as a tax collector and a publican from your presence. Sound familiar? It is repeated verbatim in the Manual of Discipline and the 18th chapter of the Gospel according to St. Matthew. Who were here? A group of Jews had set out from Jerusalem, which had gotten so involved in cruddy politics that they didn't want to stay there. What were they doing here, please? All over Qumran there's a motto, and I'm going to sing it. It's the third verse of the 40th chapter of Isaiah. Can you hear it when you go there, Jim? In the sand on a windy day. Prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. Is it any accident that this is the motto of John the Baptist? Is it any accident that this is the spirit of Jesus? The Romans are here. We will be destroyed again. We haven't forgotten the Babylonians. What in God's holy name is this all about? Let us go into the desert and purge ourselves of our sins and prepare in the desert a highway for our God. If that sounds familiar to Christians, it's because that same text appears someplace in the first, second, or third chapter of every one of the four Gospels. A group of Jews have gone to live in Jerusalem. What are they doing here? Well, there's a beautiful rule at Qumran that you're not supposed to be up in the morning and talking. You're supposed to keep silent. That wouldn't bother most of you. But at Qumran, you're supposed to be out here hoeing beans, doing menial labor. How did we find all this out? Because when DeVoe and Harding got the sense that this little 2-acre site was the place where the community had lived,
they began to dig.
And the very first day they found a pantry out of which they carried 1,000 plates and jars and pots. During my first 5 years in Egypt, I was a bachelor. It's a tough thing to be in a foreign country as a bachelor. There was a streetcar by my office that it terminated at the pyramids. And many a Saturday afternoon, I went out to the pyramids by tramway, and I would walk the Sahara Desert. And I got in the habit of walking with heavy heels because I thought maybe I would make the great archaeological discovery of the 20th century. And I have pretty fair hearing, and thud, my career is made. In 5 years, I heard one promising thud. I reached down and pulled up a jar handle left by the British in 1947. That's the end of my archaeology. In one day, they pulled out more than 1,000 pots and pans and jars. Come next door with me, and I will show you up on this little 2-acre site at Qumran, a dining room 72 feet long. Now, if a Bedouin and his wife are dragging a camel across the desert and build that kind of overnight lodging, Lord have mercy. This is a community. Next to it, would you take off your shoes because you're going to stand on holy ground. Next to it is the Library of Qumran. Think about it, would you? A smallish room in which people studied, kept their manuscripts, copied. Dear God, did you ever think of what it's like to have to copy manuscripts? It would drive you bananas. Out of that little room, we have benches, desks finished off in hard-baked clay, metal ink pots, and metal pens in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem. Those of you who have Baptist propensities would love to know that there's an ingenious system of draining the water off of the hills in Gibraltar fashion, and that they dug out 12 cisterns from the solid rock at Qumran. Now, you got to want to be baptized pretty badly to get that kind of water. With staircases, circular and straight, you could go down to the water. Out on the edge of this little 2-acre plateau, a row of simple rooms where a monk could read or study or meditate or do whatever a monk does when he's monkeying around, I do not know. Still up on this site, but outside the wall, a cemetery in which we have discovered more than 1,000 graves. Now, you've got to stay in a place a while to have a cemetery with 1,000 graves, because if there's a massacre, you don't get a cemetery. And what do you do with the fact that almost every grave is the grave of a man or a little boy? And what do you do with the fact that they are all buried alike in a simple white shroud? Come back to Qumran, will you? No talking before morning, before the sun comes up. You're down hoeing the beans if you can make them grow in salt water. And then when the sun comes up, you go up to the community house. I think, I can't prove this, you go and get water from the cisterns. You do your ablutions. You put on a white garment. You go into the dining room and take your meal in common and in silence. Every Friday afternoon, you line up as a battalion because you hate the enemies of the Lord with a perfect hatred, and you'd better do some military discipline. Occasionally, as the week goes along, you go forth two by two to man the soup kitchens which the Pharisees had established in the cities of Palestine for the poor. Life goes on at Qumran. There's a beautiful belief at Qumran. And that is that if anybody ever comes to take the community, you will not recant the faith. You would rather die because you believe in immortality. You're a good Pharisee. Life goes on at Qumran. We think that life was established there by about 150 before the Common Era. We know that life was badly disrupted in about 31 before the Common Era, before Christ, when there was an earthquake in the Middle East that shook almost everything down, and in the cisterns at Qumran we have got fissures this wide that have been repaired. We know they were back here by the time of the death of Herod the Great, and right across the historic life of Jesus of Nazareth. What happened to Qumran? About halfway through the next paragraph, I will leave the journal of the 10th Roman Legion and indulge in impure, adulterated Beck. Could you tolerate that, please? This is important to me. What happened to the brothers at Qumran? Some of you know, and if you don't, get it, that Rome had had a dickens of a time with the Jews. Some of you know that the Roman emperor didn't even want the Judean province. He passed it to the Senate. They didn't want it, they passed it back. It was like a hot potato. And finally there came an emperor to Rome, every Jew worth his or her salt knows this, there came an emperor to Rome who said, I'm going to be done with the damn Jew. Excuse me, I do not wish to be quoted out of historic context, but that's what they did. And the Roman Empire sent 100,000 troops to this little Jerusalem town, which is like sending the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy against Omaha. It's ridiculous. But in this case, 2 years later, with unbelievable casualties on either side, the general of the army went home to be emperor of Rome. And so badly did he want to win that he sent his own firstborn son, Titus, to be the general against the Jews. And in 70 AD, as every devout Jew knows, Jerusalem fell for the second time. The city was leveled. It was a capital crime to be circumcised or possess, hold a copy of Torah in your own possession. Many, many Jews were killed. Within a few years, Jerusalem was to be occupied only by the Gentiles. But about 1,000 Jews, I don't want to bore you, about 1,000 Jews escaped from Jerusalem and went down at an old fortress on the Dead Sea called Masada. And hold up, say it with me, will you please? Masada. Every Jew knows this name with pain. And Titus, the general, was so furious that he didn't get them all that he ordered the 10th Roman Legion, this is historically documentable, to go from Jerusalem up to the Sea of Galilee, where they spent their last night in Tiberias, which we shall see in just a moment, with orders that they were to go south along the Jordan River until they came to Masada. Did they know about Qumran? I don't know. And clean out all vestiges of Jewish life. Word came to Qumran that the 10th Roman Legion was coming. I can see it, but I don't have any documentation. I think the head of the monastery said, let's make clean linen. Let's make some big jars. We have one at my school. Go into the library and take off the pegs, the scroll that you've been studying, the one your parish sent when you came to the monastery, the one your mother-in-law sent as a thank offering when you promised you'd leave home and never come back. Go into the library and take the scroll, wrap it in clean linen, put it in a jar, tie the lid on, the jars have big ears, and take it up to the hills. The Romans will come, the Romans will go, but we must never have a Roman spit on the name of God, which is so holy, we have not pronounced it for 200 years. And I think the monks were working away at that. And I think they woke up one morning and looked, and there, way ahead of schedule, was the 10th Roman Legion. What to do? I reckon the monks moved harder that and faster that morning than they had moved for years. And they went into the library and simply scooped up arms full of manuscripts, more than half the library, and ran to Qumran cave number 4, which is a hole in the ground, opened at either end, and dumped like a pile of shelled corn in the middle of a granary. More than half of the manuscripts we found at Qumran. Dear colleagues, will you help me understand how DeVoe and Harding must have felt when they entered Qumran number 4 and saw there, peppered over with sand and dust, manuscripts that had been untouched by human hands for nearly 2,000 years. What happened to the brothers at Qumran? That's easy, says a professor at Princeton. They became Christians. Well, everybody knows, of course, that the Roman forces coming down the Jordan Valley had Baptist tracts in their pocket and said, if you Jews will just sign on the line, we'll let you all. Oh, no, they didn't. The Roman forces coming down that stinking Jordan Valley said to themselves, what in the name of Zeus are we doing here? I'd rather be back with the bubbly wine and the bubbly Germanic girls on the Via Veneto. Let's clean this stinking place up as fast as we can. I believe the reason we never heard from Qumran is because there was nobody left to tell us. And some of you are going to say, wow, you really want an exciting end to your stay in Corpus Christi, don't you? And I will remind you that every good Jew knows that 1,000 refugees 15 miles south of Qumran were attacked 6 weeks later by the same 10th Roman Legion. And every Jew knows that those 1,000 refugees from Jerusalem at Masada took a vow that they would not be taken by the cruel Romans, that they would kill each other and commit suicide. And every Jew knows that after more than a month of fighting, when the 10th Roman Legion crawled up on top of Masada, out of 1,000 people, they found 2 old hags and 5 little babies who were completely dehydrated. All the rest had been killed, or killed each other, or committed suicide. Do you now understand why, when they dug up Masada, university students in the Jewish tradition from all over the world came and said, this is 2,000 years later our chance to honor martyrs. The 10th Roman Legion hit this place. And I think if you'd been sitting up on one of these Judean cliffs on a June afternoon in 71 or 2 of this era, you would have heard the whine of Damascene steel across the throats of my brothers. You would have heard the death rattle. You would have seen those Roman soldiers putting a torch to anything that would burn. You would see why they kicked up their heels and dropped 400 solid silver shekels in the sand, 200 of them from the town of Tiberias, where they spent their last Saturday night. And later that evening, wouldn't it have stunned you to know that as the sun set across Qumran and silence came, it was to be uninterrupted from 71 of this era until in 1946, a shepherd boy threw a rock into a cave, and instead of hearing the bleating of a kid, heard the resounding crash of pottery. Why bother you with the story? You've been awfully kind. You may be bored, but you're kind. I've got 3 reasons because I'm a trained clergyman. I'll say the first one 4 different ways. So what else is new? But hear me, please. The reason I want to tell you this Qumran material is because we have found more than 600 biblical manuscripts. Let me say it a second way. From Qumran, we have got 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament in Hebrew except the book of Esther. Whoopee. If you had been asking me to nominate 1 book for exclusion, guess which one it would have been. Now don't get nervous if you've got an aunt named Esther. Who hasn't? 600 manuscripts, 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament in Hebrew except the book of Esther. Let me say it 2 more ways. We have got a preponderance of copies of 3 books of the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Psalms. Those of you who know the New Testament know that it leans very hard on 3 books of the Old Testament. Chorus, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Psalms. And according to the very best judgment of scholars and the carbon 14 dating test and the discernment of the ink and the way the letters are written, the manuscripts from Qumran are generally dated at about 50 BC. In one place, we found 1 or more copies of every book of the Old Testament, the Bible of Jesus and the early church, that are 1,000 years older than our previously oldest copies. You say, so what? And I will say to you that I can stand up in any university community and say, not, you've got to believe. I don't say that. But I can say, I belong to a literary tradition that had integrity for the last 2,300 years. That's something. You know, when I hear a bishop pontificating about the Bible, I want to stick a pin in his pontificator. If I could figure out where it is. Because, you know, it isn't you and me and our loyalty that has given us these manuscripts. Please hear me. I'll tell you who gave us these manuscripts with integrity. It was those dear monks sitting in drafty rooms across 1,000 years with uncorrected vision. I've been wearing glasses since I was 14 months old. I saw that little boy in front of church today. I saw him. And I've never been able to understand how anybody survives the headaches and the pain of uncorrected vision. And those old scribes sitting there writing with anything but a Parker 51 on parchment, lining the text with their nose so they could find it. Won't you say a prayer for them? They are our benefactors. So the first reason I bother you with this is the manual. The second reason is the fragment literature. Boy, I'm really getting way out, huh? What would you do if you had baskets and baskets and baskets of dried up, broken parchment that had texts on it? Start the fire with it? Well, some people have. But what would you do if you knew that if you worked and put those together, you would find another psalm, a liturgy? My old boss at the American University of Cairo, where I taught for 10 or 11 years, later became John Kennedy's ambassador to Egypt. So I used to be entertained occasionally at the American Embassy. I was there at dinner one night. On my left was a well-corseted English archaeologist, a man. And on my right was Mrs. Carl Munt, the wife of the United States Senator from South Dakota. She leaned across my soup to say to the English archaeologist, "What in addition to a bulldozer and dynamite do you use in archaeology?" And when he recovered and got himself laced up again, he looked at her and said, "A fingernail file and a toothbrush." She never really knew what hit her. The fragment literature, tweezers under glass. Nincompoops don't apply for these jobs. Even with affirmative action, nincompoops, tweezers under glass. Friend of mine is a Belgian priest. He's been sitting in the workroom of the Rockefeller Museum for 34 years, tweezers under glass. I said to him last time I was there, "How you doing?" He sneered lovingly, "Come back in 75 years and I'll tell you." But I admire him because he's producing literature that arose out of the tradition of which I am a part. Think of the fragment literature, would you please? I've got a third reason, and I may have to be carried out on this one. But would you get it and get it good? Qumran was an experiment. We say there were Essenes, but we're not sure. There were surely Pharisees. And the way it was told to me as a kid in Nebraska is that all the Pharisees had congealed about 200 B.C., and that Jesus was the only one who had a bright idea in the whole Judaics. A pox on such garbage. It was the Pharisees who were believing in resurrection after death. It was the Pharisees who said, sacrifice is interesting, but prayer is more important. Look at the Psalms. It was the Pharisees who said women can participate in the life of the community. It was the Pharisees who had 400 synagogues in Jerusalem at the very time the temple was still there when Jesus was a boy. It was the Pharisees who let a little boy come back to Galilee and get up in the pulpit and read the morning lesson even though he was not ordained. It was the Pharisees who offered their lives because the Sadducees said you must not read the prophets in holy liturgy.
I want to say to you, let's stop using the word Pharisee as though it were some legitimate equivalent for nigger. I want to say to you that the Pharisees are my fathers and mothers. I want to say to you, I believe Jesus was a Pharisee. I believe Matthew was a Pharisee. Of course there were good and bad Pharisees, just as there are good and bad Christians. Of course Jesus talked sharply to the Pharisees, just the way Dr. Solomon speaks more sharply about you to your face than he does anybody else in Corpus Christi, because sometimes we are whited sepulchres filled with dead men's bones. I don't think Jesus was just taunting them and twisting the tail of a dead horse. I think he loved them. And when he said to his followers, except your righteousness be greater than the righteousnesses of the Pharisees, he wasn't putting them down. He was saying, they're good, you got to be even better. That, I think, is why 20 years after the death of Jesus, Paul of Tarsus was still saying, I am a Pharisee of the Pharisees and out of the tribe of Benjamin. I think of Gamaliel and I thank God. I think of Nicodemus and I thank God. I think of Matthew and I thank God. And I think of my Lord Jesus. And I am convinced that he was trained not as a Sadducee. You see, when the temple fell, the Sadducees disappeared. But every good Jew in Houston and Corpus Christi knows that they are a Pharisee right now. So be careful how you use that word. I'm indebted to the Pharisees. They are my fathers and mothers in the faith. And Qumran is their attempt to find a new way, because the old way aren't working. Won't you give them credit? I am not a New Testament scholar. I may not even be an Old Testament scholar. But I don't want to live in a New Testament church. I want to live in a biblical church. Please don't misunderstand. I am not an ordained rabbi. I am ordained in the tradition of Jesus Christ. And I have the honor to be his servant. And I look at him and say, oh, bright and morning star, hope of the world, my salvation. But I also have to add, don't show me the flower without showing me the roots. It would be grossly unfair if you didn't have a chance at the same audience that I do, and I would now like to receive such questions as you are inclined to ask. Corrections, comments, please. Please, sir. No, I think we have begun to sense their importance, their confirming character. I think we will work on it for years to come, but I think the main lines have been established. That's one of three questions I like to receive. I want to say to you, and please, you will not say, well, what did you expect a minister to say? I can say some things you didn't expect. But I'd like to have it pointed out very clearly that the manuscripts from 50 BC and the manuscript from 1000 AD are essentially in agreement on anything of theological importance. They are not verbatim in agreement. This is death for the fundamentalist. But then fundamentalism is not so much a theological position as it is a psychological problem. It's a hunting for authority. It's a hunting for external authority. You see, Hebrew was alive as a language until 500 AD, and the texts were fluid. They were being changed. And there is an occasional difference of wording. Does that bother you? Because if it does, I'll see you after meeting. Words change in meaning.
In Shakespeare's time, if a woman said to her husband, "Honey, when are you going to hang the storm windows?" and he said, "Presently," that means he's already folded the Stratford Times. He's on the way to the horse barn. Nowadays, if a man says "presently," nobody knows when. Words have meaning. Oh, I got to say one. Do we have time for one other, please? When Webster was getting his English dictionary together, you know, he got a little tired. And one evening, instead of being up in the parlor whispering sweet somethings to Mrs. Webster, he was down in the scullery whispering sweet somethings to the scullery maid, when all of a sudden Mrs. Webster popped in and she said, "Noah, I am surprised." And he, ever the scholar, said, "No, my dear, we are surprised. You are amazed." Words have meaning. I went to a party once. Let me just follow this because this is really important. And you will note that your pastor has put the thumb on the most important single question. The Old Testament Revised Standard Version was not to appear until 1952. The text from Qumran became available in 1948. The Revised Standard Version Committee, meeting in Massachusetts, sent a cable to Professor Burroughs in Jerusalem saying, "Get a hold of photostatic copies of those two Isaiahs found in Qumran 1, remember? Spend a year at our expense. Go through and see if there are any significant differences." At the end of a year, I heard Miller Burroughs say at a cocktail party one time, I had 6 footnotes. And then as he rolled around on his chair, he said, "After later thinking, I would be perfectly willing to forego all of them, so far as any meaning is concerned." Now, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, but I want to say, think of that scribe sitting in a drafty room, copying. With a flick of his bick, he could have made a fool out of all the bishops in Christendom. But he didn't. And I'm proud of that kind of a tradition. Other question, please. That's the second question. This crowd is uncommonly bright. Oh. Can't you keep anything quiet? The question is it possible that Jesus was at Qumran? Let me say to you, there's absolutely no historical evidence whatsoever that Jesus was at Qumran. Now let me give you the correct answer. Jesus came many a time down the east side of the Jordan because he got tired of going through Samaria and having to look over his shoulder all the way, and crossed at Jordan River here, when Qumran would have been as obvious as that first indirect light on the wall. He couldn't. As brilliant as Jesus was, in a dinky country that's half the size of a healthy Texas county, Jesus couldn't have been oblivious to a major religious movement. Could I add 2 little things on that? I think there's a reason why Jesus came to be baptized by John the Baptist. And that is that John the Baptist, whether or not resident in Qumran, shared this dream. Prepare ye in the desert a highway for our God. We got to do something different. Repent. The kingdom of God is at hand. A new age has got to come. And John the Baptist made the terrible mistake of being born before Jesus. By which I mean he always has to take not only second place, but way down place. Do you hear what I mean? We so glorify Jesus that we do not want to acknowledge any of Jesus' sources. That's one of the dangers of having a hero. Wouldn't it be great if the New Testament had said, Jesus demonstrated an idea that had come to him from Qumran. Jesus demonstrated an idea that was first passed to him when he and John the Baptist were playing tag one Passover. And you know that happened. But to make a hero, we cut it all away. Do I sound as though I was against Jesus? No. He became like one of us, and like one of us, he learned from the setting. He was uncommonly brilliant, but he still learned. Even St. Paul persists in that teaching. So I would like to suggest that in my best judgment, and I could not prove it if my jugular vein depended on it, Jesus knew about Qumran. And I would like to think that he went to be baptized of John the Baptist. You know, you got to have a reason for being baptized by a cousin, especially if he's a hippie. How blithely we read, I got to stop, but how blithely we read the text in the New Testament. John the Baptist was in the desert from the time he was a little child. So he came down one morning at the age of 5 and said, "Mama, 2 bowls of Wheaties because I'm making it for the desert." I'm not being silly. I wonder if a little boy can live in the desert alone. I wonder if a little boy may have to go to a monastery. I stand at Qumran and I see the graves of those little boys. And I'm not so much a Protestant, but that I can honor the fact that a celibate order has to have other people's children and love them and rear them. But life in the desert is hard, and some little boys didn't make it. Come on. Please, one other question or comment. Yes.
If in the year 2087, a professor of the Old Testament came to give the Ray West lecture here, would you speculate on what insights he might have that are not generally held and known today?
About the Old Testament or the Bible, biblical faith generally?
Yes. Or both?
I'd like to say both. I hope there'll be at least 2 lines. I'm surprised I'm so prepared. You will be too when you hear the answer. But I'd like to see, this is wishful thinking, huh? I'd like to see by 2087 that the biblical community would return to its birthright and say, God made the divine being known to us beautifully in the biblical period. God revealed his being to Luther and Wesley in the Catholic Counter-Reformation. And I'd like to hear them saying, for a time in the 19th and 20th century, there was a lot of people who sort of thought that it was all sewed up. And I'd like to hear people say, no, the Holy Spirit is speaking to us about continuing situations in the life of the biblical community. I'd like that. Now that's happening. Of course, what I'd really like is that if we get a foresighted pope soon, please, class, hear me. I want my grandchildren to go to Vatican Council III. I want the Methodists to be at Vatican Council III, not just as observers, but as voting members. I want to get the body of Christ together, not so much in institutions, but as the Christian world speaks to the rest of the world. And we're going to have a hard time in the 21st century, even if we hang together. We've made real progress. There were Protestant observers, there were Jewish observers at Vatican Council II. There were women there, they didn't vote, but they were there. I don't think it's ridiculous to think that we are moving toward the time. Already, I know there are many Catholics who are more Protestant than some of us. I can't live without some nuns. Make of that what you will. Many of the orders of the nuns are the cutting edge of the Christian church. That's one of the things. Second thing we've got to do is to open up serious dialogue with other great world religious traditions. It's no good going on cursing the 3/4 of the human race who did not get born into the Christian tradition and probably won't be born. Does that mean I don't believe in missions? Of course I believe in missions. But I believe in missions that will have to recover from 250 years of Christian imperial abuse in Africa and Asia, which the Africans and Asians haven't forgotten yet. And I believe in a missionary program that is not monologue but dialogue. And I believe that God has put light in many a good Muslim and Jew and Hindu and Buddhist, and I want to look for the light that is already in them. My Lord Jesus met a Samaritan who had never been allowed in the temple, and he said to the Jews, "Why don't you act like that?" These are lines I'd like to see. And then we will sense a growing unity. And we will discover, as Martin Marty says, that we can have an open church that doesn't have to have a God of prey, P-R-E-Y. Just because we got God in our heart, we got to put everybody else down. Why? It's ridiculous. That's not liberal.